Hello and welcome to the Savoy Originals. I'm Alex Zane, and each week I'll be speaking to someone that the legendary Savoy, with its history of creativity and playing host to cultural icons through the decades, considers to be a true original in their field. Today, I'm joined by one of the greatest athletes our country has ever produced.
In the 1500 metres, the gun goes. I felt like I had something on my shoulders picking me up. I literally felt like I was floating over the track.
Joining me is, of course, author, broadcaster and double Olympic champion, Dame Kelly Holmes. Now, just before we get going, I want to take a moment to thank our wonderful sponsors, Lauren Perrier, who have treated us to something truly special. Dame Kelly Holmes and I will be enjoying a glass or two of Lauren Perrier Heritage. This is the latest release from the family-owned house, located in a small Grand Cru village in the middle of the vineyards in Champagne, where it has stood for more than two centuries. It was Bernard de Nonancourt who took the reins of Lauren Perrier in 1948 and defined the unique style of Lauren Perrier: freshness, elegance, and purity. Kelly, wonderful to have you here. Thank you for joining me today. Here's to you.
Cheers. Cheers. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
True Savoy original. This. Okay, yeah. I think it's bad luck if you don't.
You have to look to mean the intent of drinking.
The eyes thing, right?
Ooh. Thank you.
Oh, that's lovely. Oh, okay.
It's a good start.
It is a good start. It's a great start. And now to start properly. This podcast is about those mysterious qualities that make remarkable people remarkable. So I want to start by journeying back to one of your most unmissable victories. The double gold wins for the 800 metres and the 1500 metres at the 2004 Athens Olympics, which was described as the greatest performance in the history of British distance running. I went back and rewatched these on YouTube, which made me cry, actually. It's very emotional watching them, purely because you've seen someone achieve their dream, and also because I don't know a whole lot about the tactics of middle distance running. So to me, they play out like a little mini sports movie with the greatest beats from that movie. It's like, she's gone to the back. Why is she at the back? And then at the last minute, you're flying past everyone. It's an incredible watch. If you cast your mind back, do you remember how you felt the minute you realised, I've won the 800 metres to begin with?
I remember distinctly crossing the line in the 800 metres, thinking I'd won, but then thinking, well, I couldn't have won the 800 metres. You know, it was almost like instant, I've won, no, I haven't. It was kind of that, did I actually win? Because I'd never, ever had in my psyche that I'd become Olympic 800 metre champion. I'd been very good at it. I'd been medalled in it multiple times, but I hadn't dreamt of it. I hadn't visualised it, nothing.
This is because the 1500 metres was the goal.
Yes.
So this was like the secondary event.
Yes. Right. So since I was 14, the 1500 metres was my goal. But I was very good at 800 metres. And when I won it, it was a mixed feeling, because when you cross the line, it's by your chest, not your foot, not your head, not your arm, whatever, it's by your chest. And it was like, well, now I know, it was 0.05 of a second that separated, literally, I think, the first four or five people. I mean, it was like that close. It was like a hair. But as soon as I finished and I started to celebrate, I felt like a fool. I thought, oh my God, what if I haven't? And there was a great clip that I always see where I'm like, my arms up, and then I'm kind of like bringing them down in slow motion, and like, oh, don't celebrate.
Because you don't want the clip to be you celebrating that you've won, only to people go, oh, second place.
Exactly. So I was thinking I needed validation. I needed to know. And there's two things that happen when you cross the line. You have a slow-mo on a big screen at the end of that elliptical stadium. You know, there's 80 to 100,000 people, and this big screen's at the end. Finishing line goes in slow motion because, of course, they're replaying it. They have to make sure. So they've got the computers, the data, everything, and they're doing this somewhere up in the stadium. But you're seeing it as a observer. This guy on the inside of the track was a photographer, and he had this about three cameras, and he's jumping around. He's going, Kelly, you've won! And he was a British photographer, and I was like, ah! I And then at the same time, it comes up first. And I was just like, I didn't know what to do. Everyone laughs at my eyes popping out of my head. I mean, it's like a moment.
I mean, I think your eyes are allowed to pop out of your head, especially when you didn't expect to win. Yeah. That must have been such a moment. And you became the first British female track and field athlete to win two gold medals in a single Olympics. Mm-hmm. And I believe to date you are still the only female British athlete to do so.
Yeah.
Journeying back to the very beginning, with what sounds like a simple question, but quite a big question. Why the 1500 metres?
Why the 1500 metres? It's quite simple. I was good at it. I found sport through school and through an athletics club. And my coach at the time just said, I want you just to run. But I want you to talk to all these adults that were running through as we go for a warm-up. He said, because I've heard that you talk a lot at school. Great. What's my mother said? And he just decided by the way that I ran that maybe I could do 1,500 metres. But I was also inspired by an Olympic Games and watching a man called Sebastian Coe win the 1,500 metres at the Olympic Games. And that's what ignited my passion for that event.
So it was it a gradual thing then? You did a bit of running yourself, you saw Sebastian Coe, and then you made the decision? Or was there a really definite eureka moment where you just went, that's it?
So I started running at school when I was 12, and my PE teacher had encouraged me to run because I was winning everything at sports day, and I was not the academic type. So I engaged with PE quite well and loved it. And it was actually in summer holidays when I was 14 years old, the Los Angeles Olympics were on. And I remember watching some British superstars like Tessa Sanderson winning a gold medal in the javelin, you know, and kind of seeing Daley Thompson and all these British superstars. But then I saw Sebastian Coe, who was meant to be 800 metres Olympic champion and lost. And there was a massive story around, could he come back and would he medal? Having not won the medal that he had been training for, believed he'd get, and he came and won. And I was so inspired with the comeback, his face, his determination, because he'd already won a medal 4 years ago, but I was only 10 then, so I didn't really know much about him, but just sort of hearing the story, which is lovely at Olympic Games because you hear the backstory of an athlete. It's not them just running around the track and winning or swimming and touching the end. You know, you actually hear about the person.
That's such a weird thing. Having been to sporting events, the first one I ever went to, I found it the strangest experience because you don't have someone going, and that's that player and that's that, and this is the story about them. You sort of have to follow it yourself, which if you're a layman like me, can be quite difficult.
Yeah. Definitely. And I think that's the thing with sport. What sport does bring, it engages so many people because it's, you know, there's no barriers really because sport is so widespread now. I mean, we look at Paris 2024 that's finished and all the sports that have come to the fore, and you've got young people right up until mid-50s winning Olympic gold medals. And so actually it can engage a lot of people now by the human endeavour, by the excitement and the thrill, the hard work, the tears, the cheers. And I think that's what kind of inspires people.
I mean, so at 14, though, to sort of go, right, at 14, I want to be an Olympian. That's...
Not just Olympian, Olympic champion.
An Olympic champion, so of course. Like, to have that focus at that age and that goal, I mean... What do you think it was that drew you specifically to the track and not, as most 14-year-olds, out partying, seeing their friends, going to clubs, trying to get into clubs at 14?
I think sometimes it's a little bit of an identity, kind of feeling a purpose and feeling valid, you know, because I kind of suppose I didn't really know who I was when I was younger. And, you know, when you're unsure of what you can do, whether you're actually good at anything. And I think being, like I say, the sort of not academic type at school and not really getting much support from home with the academic work, when you find something that gives you a fire in the belly, a passion, and you go, wow, I can actually be someone, people take notice of you. And I think I just gravitated towards wanting to feel good at something. And because I was very good at it, it made me feel even better. So And I just don't know why or how anyone creates a dream other than seeing something and feeling it and going, oh, yeah, I really want to do it. It's all words. It's fluffy clouds, isn't it, when you're younger? Let's face it. So it was a fluffy cloud.
It was a fluffy cloud, but when you said it out loud, was it like, oh, I'm good at it. That's a great goal to say out loud, to sort of say, I'm going to be an Olympic champion. Or did you really believe it in your bones? Were you like, I am actually going to do this?
So I think I was successful quite young, because when I started running at 12 in the winter, it came to the summer and it was English Schools Championships. Now, to get to an English Schools All England, you've got to be best in your club, best in your school, best in the county, and then you get selected for the biggest school event, the English Schools. And when I was 13, 6 months after starting sort of cross country, which I really hated, I won. So I'd already had a taste of what winning is and being the best at the highest level. So I think for me, it's just creating, well, what else is there that you can be good at? Now, at that age, we didn't have things like Grand Prix and Diamond Leagues. You know, you're trying to win the county championships or the national championships. And I think that taste of success was something that I loved. Mm. And I hated failing, but failing made me work harder. And would I say that I had a distinct, this is about goals and, you know, processes? No, it was just, I think it's almost as well, if you see it's possible, you know, I didn't, regardless of him being a man, I just saw a British person who won an event that I, as a young kid, was running in, I saw a gold medal around the neck with the British flag flying and the national anthem playing, and thinking, wow, it gave me goosebumps. So for me, it's like, I want to be Olympic champion. It could well have been fluffy cloud words back then, but I just felt I could. I suppose it's later in life that I believed I could do it.
So you've got your three best friends who are like, yeah, we reckon you can do this. You've got Miss Page, who's like, yeah, I believe in you. How important was the belief of others in your ability? Would you have pushed and carried on and done as well as you did at that age were it not for these people around you going, no, I think you can do this, Kelly?
Yeah, fundamentally, it's about having someone in your corner that believes in you. And absolutely, it was my PE teacher, Debbie Page, who is still my friend, who told me I could be good at something. And I think when you're younger, you do crave for people around you to, you know, believe in you a little bit. You know, you just want somebody that pushes you. We're kind of quite needy when we're younger anyway, aren't we? But that one person that pretty much took me aside and said, you know, you can either do nothing or you can use your talent and be really good. Mm. And I never forgot that. I never forgot that one person in my life at that time that made me feel validated.
So have you ever analysed, I'm sure you've probably considered it, where the apart from the euphoria that comes with winning, where that desire to prove yourself actually came from? You might not know. I mean, people don't. It can be just ingrained in them. But have you ever considered where it came from?
Well, I think it's probably a little bit of a personality trait, of course. There has to be something in there somewhere that makes me a bit more in determination. But I suppose, you know, if like as a group of people, and every time you're with a different group of people, you don't feel like, who are you? Like, you know, everybody else seems confident and everyone else seems to just be going around and doing their thing and having maybe support of people when you just feel like nobody almost. Mm. So I feel that maybe because I was so different to everyone else around me, I grew up in Kent, you know, white and white, Count of Kent, as I say it, you know, as a mixed race child to a white mother, white siblings, white stepdad, white school friends, white everybody around me, I'm different, I stand out. So I think it was almost like owning who I was and not being intimidated by what I was, using my talent as a way of saying, this is me type thing.
Standing out on your terms, as it were. It must be quite a nice feeling, like on the most basic level, of being able to walk into a room and have heads turn and go, that's Kelly Holmes who does this.
Yeah, because it's all, I was the kid outside the classroom most of the time. Everyone just used to like half or take the mickey because I was all right out. I thought, oh, here we go again. You know what I mean? And I was thinking, but you know, now we call it things like neurodiversity. We have a word for people that can't learn very quick and have to process a bit slower and kind of need somebody to support them and help them through that journey. And I think I definitely fitted in that category that I really couldn't compute what somebody's talking to me at. They painted me a picture and described it in a way that I could understand it. You know, I feel I'm a smart person, I'm very creative, I know I'm good at what I do, but there's certain areas that absolutely I would need help on that I just can't compute, and that's fine. But back then, of course, as a youngster, they didn't really segregate people in that way. They didn't look at you as a person and go, God, you're really good at this area, but for some reason, you're just not clicking. They didn't have time. Teachers don't have time. You know, they get paid to do a job, and realistically, unless you have one like my PE teacher that really, really cares, people get lost in that system. I'm very lucky that a talent was identified that happened to be in a setting that was conducive to my way of learning, listening to instructions, telling me what I needed to do, how I needed to do it. I'll go and do it because I understood it. And then when I was good, it makes me feel good and you want to do it more because you get the euphoria of thinking, God, you know, this is great. I don't have to sit outside all the time. You know, and then people wanted to be in my team. And my name, Kelly, was known in the school because I was the fastest kid. I'd beat, you know, youngsters that were 2 years older than me. Everyone wanted me in their team. So I'm like, yeah, I'm going to take it. So hence going to an athletics club and getting better and then becoming even better than just the kid with talent. Everyone knew who I was at that school.
I mean, yeah, just to pull the curtain back, you are talking to someone who always was picked last in PE. I was the kid that no one wanted on their team. They were trying to give me away at the end. We'll play better without him. So that's amazing. Chess club, I was brilliant, but not.
See,
not
there you go. PE. I would be rubbish at chess. So.
You just described yourself as quite good at what you do, which I think is a little bit of an understatement. So I want to ask you a question that we ask every guest on this show, which is, what do you think it takes to be a true original? Which you clearly are.
There's an element of obviously self-belief that takes a person to do what they do, that feat. But no one sort of sees the everything else that goes with that. Because you kind of see in sport an end result, right? Good or bad, depending on how you perceive it or how that athlete has articulated whether it's good or bad, right? You buy into the emotion. And sometimes they're tears of joy and sometimes they're tears of, I feel like I've not, you know, I've missed out. And I suppose there's a big combination of having really good people around you, never giving up on what you perceive to be your destiny, learning that if you fail at the first barrier that's hit you or disappointment, you're not going to get anywhere. So I think a champion really just fights through the highs and the lows, what they're trying to do. And at different stages, believe differently in your ability to do things, you know, because people forget the fact that that end was through fighting, fighting, fighting. And that became a mindset challenge, really. Because I had 7 years of injuries, ruptured calves, torn Achilles, stress fractures, I had glandular fever, tonsillitis, 3 operations on my stomach, and I had depression, all leading up to 2004. Yeah, I'd won 11 international medals. Now, that's not just by luck. That's by the fact that I kept going, kept driving, kept believing, kept wanting to be the person that I said at school, that I'm going to prove I can be good at something. And maybe that was the driver. I think sometimes adversity helps push you to drive, because if that's the innate thing that makes you feel valid or wanted or to be something, that was my driver. I'm not going to give up because otherwise I failed myself. So I'm going to keep going. And it just created this momentum of thinking positive when the negatives happened. Because every time I had an injury, my first ever bad injury was actually when I was 26 at my first Olympic Games. And I came fourth on the line, pipped on the line. But I was running with a stress fracture. And after coming fourth, running on the line, people thought I was crazy. Like, why are you running with a stress fracture? You've been told that you might break your leg. And I'm like, yes, but what if I give up? I won't know. Mm. If only it's too late. You know, and that's what I had. Everyone thought I was distraught. Now I was, because coming fourth is like the worst place to be. But I kept thinking, I've come fourth against the best in the world with a stress fracture that was physically and then emotionally painful, because it was kind of that realization that actually my dream is slipping from my hands. And I flipped it into a positive. Something is telling me to keep going. Something inside is driving me to still think, if this happens, look, I'm so close. So every time it was like, surely I'm better than I think I am, because I'm fighting and becoming one of the world's best athletes with struggles, like literally battles to get there. My life was consumed with fixing myself and still being on a start line. Everything around me was consumed with the need to be at that championship, because maybe I might win. And I think having that somewhere innate ability to fight for what you want makes you be good at what you do. And it doesn't matter what that is. It doesn't have to be sport. It's just having it inside you to realise that I'm fighting for a reason. I might not know exactly what it is now, but something's telling me to keep going. Well, you've got to listen to that in a talk. Now, you go into 2004 with no doubts in my head. I had no injuries, no doubts. All I had was me to think, I've gone through all this, I'm still here, and this is my moment. Like, I believe in fate, and I do believe it is my destiny at that time.
And when you talk about like doing it and proving to yourself, proving that the 14-year-old was right, I'm going to do this, I'm going to fight for this, I'm going to carry on. Do you do it for you, or do you do it because of how, to go back to what you were saying about the way you're perceived as a winner, you've said it to enough people. How much of that can you actually quantify? How much is for you and proving it to yourself, and how much is to prove it to the other people, who, not even the ones who've just supported you, but people who've heard you say, I'm going to do this?
I think there's a little bit of each of those. I think first and foremost for me personally, it was proving to myself. It's so hard to describe what happens in somebody's head and how, you know, these different things are ticking. And I just needed to do it. I just wanted to do it. I just felt, I don't know, just something was always driving me. And then I think there's an element of proving your doubters wrong, which is a driver as well.
It is.
Because you just want to think, no, I can do this. And maybe it's a bit, you know, sometimes it's just for me, it feels selfish, but being an athlete's selfish, because, and it has to be, otherwise you're not going to be Olympic champion. Sometimes you have to be so driven and focused. That might be selfish to other people, but that's my life. Then there, like I say, an element at different stages possibly where you've heard or you know people are writing you off and you're just thinking, you haven't got a clue what I'm going through, and yet you've written me off. So you want to come back and almost do the two-finger, I did it type attitude. That wasn't my driver, but it did satisfy me.
That's interesting, because there's an argument, you know, we wouldn't be the first people to say, yeah, I was driven by that. But how much you should be driven by that is where the question mark lies, isn't it? Should you thrive on people's negativity to prove them wrong or not?
No, not on other people's negativity. You can thrive on, I think, your self-doubts and then try and flip them around to kind of prove to yourself, because a lot of people with self-doubt just don't achieve. They just don't get anywhere, and you miss so much talent. So many talented people don't get places because of their self-doubt. So for me, it was about, you know, if something was perceived to be a negative, I would find a way around it and think, well, what's the positive? Because it's easy to go negative and not give up. I would never be here sitting in this chair if I'd given up at any one of those downfalls that I believed I had. So, you know, I feel like every time you have... I also think every time you have something that brings you down and you've fought through it, if you reflect on it, that gives you strength. You know, think, well, I've got through this before. And if something else comes, you're like, well, I've already got through it once. I can get through it again. Might be a slightly different scenario, slightly different position, but you have got through what you perceive to be a struggle in your life. You've got through it, you go again. And that's what I kept doing, just going and going and going again. Because in sport, there's going to be an end point at some stage. It's either going to be age, And I was the oldest woman in my 8 and the 1500 metres when I won. Or it's going to be a physical thing that I can no longer get over that is going to stop me ever getting back to what I'm doing. But most of the time it was an injury that was a setback that I don't know how long it's going to take to fix, but it will fix. So as long as I kept that in my head, the strength was that I can keep the rest of my body fit. I can go in the gym. I can, you know, go in the pool. I can do weight training, circuit training, stepper, cross grade. It doesn't matter because the whole point is I've got to stay fit. I've got to have endurance. I've got to have speed endurance. And I've got to stay mentally strong. So if I kept all those things together, when I was getting a professional to help me with an injury problem, your job's to get me injury free. I'll do the rest.
Right.
As soon as I'm injury free, I know how to run. I mean, I've been doing it all my life. And actually, I was one of the best in the world and I could only ruin it myself.
So because you're, when you say you're sort of overcoming something, I did it once before, I did it again, you're almost, I mean, I'm sure there's some science behind it. You're training the brain, like you're creating new furrows in your brain where it's like, this is familiar ground now, yeah. So I know how to deal with this. I can go through this process again.
Yes.
You mentioned the idea of being an athlete, being selfish. It kind of leads me on to the intensity of your training regime in the run-up to the 2004 Olympics. You described it as a killer. That's your word. Why did you describe it in that way? Just how hard was it?
It was really, really tough because at the end of the day, you're in an event where there's a lot more variables. There's people in your way. There's people who can trip you up. There's people who can slow you down. You can make a mistake. You can be out of the zone. So you have to prepare in training like that. Fast, slow, reaction, speed, consistency, pace judgment. So the training is very difficult because, of course, I was doing 8 and 1500. And the variables in those two disciplines are about speed endurance and endurance at the same time, and power. So all of those have to become my training effort. So I needed somebody who would train with me who was better than me. So I could only actually have a man that would be better than me. That guy could hit my targets in training comfortably so that I could chase somebody so that I knew that you're going to hit my targets. All I've got to do is worry about keeping on your heels, then I'll hit mine.
I think that's a really interesting thing. The idea of like looking at a situation and going, this is mine for the taking. The only person who can screw this up is me.
Mm-hmm.
How much of it is the preparation you've done, or is that winner decided almost kind of by the luck on the day?
You know, people go about the mindset piece. And I just think if everybody's in the same position physically, the mind has to take over.
Hmm.
So there's got to be a piece in there that when you stand on the line, you're either so in tune with yourself and so in the zone at that moment. And so I think like 80% really when you're on the track is up here because we're all capable of winning. So up here, it's got to be that. And that 80% is that comes down to like a hairline of possible luck. I mean, it could be luck on the day. It could be that it should have been yours on the day. It could be that that person's got the golden gift on that one day, you know, because realistically, should I have won that 800 metres on paper? Probably no. But then, why not?
So this is interesting because there is this thing called flow states, isn't there, which I find fascinating. And it seemed to me like what you did in that 800 metres and the 1500 metres was just a perfect example of flow state. Would that be right?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. There was nothing outside of, I call it like, you know, we say in the zone as an athlete, but all, like tunnel vision.
Yeah.
Like you feel, so I only had that three times in my career where I felt how I did, like in Athens, and I'd raced hundreds of times.
So that was going to ask. So it's
only three times that I ever
felt. It's quite difficult
to
access then.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think everything around you has to go, not equally right, but feel like it's all in place to get that point. Every time I've raced, I'm thinking, how do I feel? You're watching your opposition. You're second-guessing somebody making a break. You're checking that you feel good. So actually what you're doing, you're too awake with your emotions. I had it once when I broke the British record for the 1500 for the first ever time. I couldn't have been beaten that day. I don't know what it was. I remember warming up against my opposition and I'm striding and I feel like I'm 10 foot tall. You know, I was just like, oh. And I got on the track and I ran the last 500 metres on my own against the wind and I had to break this British record that had stood for 12 years. And, you know, I just don't know where it came from. Like, I literally remember, I think, about 120 metres going, Gah! Like, screaming in my head, and, you know, and then I sort of broke the British record. And then I thought, well, how did I do it? How do I get that feeling back again?
Right.
And I don't know. So when the gun goes in the 800, it's slightly different because when you're fighting down the finish line, which I was, against a formidable athlete who had been my training partner for the year before, who my coach had told me she couldn't coach me any longer because of this person, you're quite aware. And the energy of somebody else that's so good and so talented and has this golden glow can really put you off as an athlete. And I remember running down the home straight with her in the 800 metres, but reminded myself to look forward and to relax. And I remember about a few metres, 30 metres out, saying to myself, relax. And as I relaxed, I felt like I took that one step to my gold. In the 1500 metres, the gun goes. I'm so in the zone that I don't recognise, see anybody. They look like, it was like a silhouette. I felt like, so strange, I literally felt like I had something on my shoulders picking me up, like I was floating over the track. And then I got to the back corner, and there's a video that I think maybe Brendan Foster says something like, oh, it looks so easy. And I watched that back, and they're saying it looks so easy. I'm like, no, it wasn't that easy. But what I do remember is coming off that bend, looking around and thinking, when I go, that's it. That's all I've got. You know, this is 6 races in 9 days at the world-class level. And I remember in my head, the only time I really opened my brain and eyes to think, I'm at the front here, I just got to go. And suddenly, at the end of the race, it was almost like whatever was on my shoulders just dumped me down. Like, literally, because I felt it. I felt like they had just gone and I'm just now in reality. I was got picked up to my destiny and then dropped down and woken up into this, oh my God, I've just got to run the 1500 metres. I couldn't believe it. Like, I literally, it was the weirdest sensation and I'd never got that feeling before. And I had Angel tattooed on my shoulder because I literally believed somebody was picking me up and taking me there.
Now, as we sip on this exquisite Laurent Perrier Heritage, it's hard not to admire the story behind it. Bernard de Nonancourt took over the house at the end of the 1940s with a vision to challenge tradition. He wanted to create something extraordinary, and he certainly did. From reinventing the new style of champagne to creating the very latest release from the house, Laurent Perrier Heritage reflects that spirit of innovation and rich history. You mentioned some of the injuries that you suffered over the years. You have, you know, to be fair, paid a big personal price in achieving this goal, both physical injuries and difficult mental health battles that you've been through, which you spoke openly about. What made you make the decision to talk openly about it? Because I imagine, I'm guessing there is an intense pressure to just maintain a kind of the visage of everything is great for numerous reasons, you know, including the idea that, you know, we all want to believe our athletes are like A-OK. They're just out there doing the country proud, for example.
Well, I think, you know, back then, no one spoke about mental health awareness. So it's very, very difficult to approach any subject like that. It just wasn't spoken about. So one, you don't have a connector with the fact that actually you might be struggling. And two, if you do, then who are you going to tell? You know, athletes are looked at as these kind of invincible superheroes in one way. But at the end of the day, we're all human, aren't we? And nobody sees anything other than the performance at a televised event. You don't see all the hours of training. You don't see the tears we go through most of the time. You don't see the pain we're in, or the, you know, crawling off the track. No one sees any of that. They just see the performance. And do you know what? I really, really struggled with the highs and lows of the injuries. But when you're also trying to mask the kind of other things that might go on in your life, where you just want to be seen as being somebody that people respect and, you know, not have any other question marks about them. If you put everything into one thing without breathing, not taking time off, reflecting or resetting, it just becomes so intense. So all of my highs and lows were intense because, of course, you're getting injuries, they're demoralising, they're emotional, they're painful, they're all of these things, and you just go to professionals to fix you. But they fix an injury or something they can see. No one ever used to ask you, how do you feel about the fact that, you know, you're nearly there, you're really close. And it's a constant thing about performance as opposed to the human side of sport. And inside me, I knew I was a world-class athlete. You get a bad injury, you deal with it, you take a positive, you thrive to come back. Keep fighting has an impact, but you don't know it at the time because you just keep fighting for the outcome. When I was 33, I was getting ready for World Championships in Paris. Yeah, something broke. I just can't, the fight was just getting too much. And I lost the plot, basically. Had a massive breakdown in holding camp. Became a self-harmer at that time. I cut myself with scissors. Almost hurt myself because I felt hurt, like punishing myself for feeling how I was feeling. No one knew what I was going through because I couldn't, who do I talk to? I didn't know what a breakdown was. I didn't even know the word. I just knew for me, and now on reflection, that's what I'd had. So you get ready for a world championships and everyone thinks you're on form. You can't show weakness for injury, so you're not going to show it for your mental health. You've got to show up. If you don't show up, you don't race. You don't race, you don't medal. So I had to show up. And I get to that world championships, and after three races, I won a silver medal. I'm standing on the stage. A lot of the media press were trying to bring other stories up about drug cheats and all of that lot that I'd spoken about and whatever, and saying that you know, you're running with your training partner and they're helping you and da-da-da and all the negative things that press want to do just to build up, bring down, build up. That's what they do, people in the public eye anyway, let's face it. And what they didn't know, I was actually at my last whip, like I wanted to jump in a hole and not see the next day. And I just thought, you have no idea. And in a way, that became a power to me.
You know, when you mentioned selfishness earlier about, you know, to be an athlete, to be the best, you have to be selfish. Initially, I was like, oh, okay, so that's to do with the training regime, you know. But is there a selfishness as well in the sense that you don't want people to be around that side of things? Because you know how mentally hard it's going to be for you, and why would you want someone around to have to go through that with you?
I suppose it's, do people understand what you're going through? Because it's very easy for people to say, why are you doing, you know, people that don't have it inside them to really push, think they're being really kind when they say, well, maybe, you know, maybe you should just have a break, or maybe, you know, time out or whatever. They think they're being really nice, but someone so driven like me doesn't need somebody telling them, like, to stop doing what you're doing or to take time out. You need somebody just to understand. But if you don't know how to articulate that conversation, you say about talking and open up about it, and when it was affecting my mental health, what am I going to say to somebody? You know, because I'm getting ready for world champs. It would have pulled me out of that world championships. There's no way I would have got to that world championships if they knew how it was going. That would have destroyed me, because that was what gave me purpose at that time in my life. The following year, of course, I started getting injured again because I put everything into 2004. Then, of course, the euphoria of winning two gold medals, the first person to do it, you know, overrun. It's like, oh, my God. Because I'd never thought of what would happen. It's not like now where people know there's so much sort of adulation or opportunities or sponsors that come. I never thought about that. You know, I was an army girl. I just wanted to win. You know what I mean? I didn't even pluck an eyebrow, let alone what they do now. I look like models turning up on a track. You know what I mean? Because I just felt it. So suddenly I'm catapulted into this spotlight and I don't know how to handle all that spotlight. That was really difficult. You know, I get injured again. Then everyone's saying, oh, aren't you going to retire? And I thought, well, I didn't think about 1 second past winning, let alone I'm going to retire. But then, you know, did I I have the same motivation? Did I have the same drive? Did I have the hunger and fight to do it because of what happened? No, I just lost the fight. And so I decided to retire. And then I got a chance to write my first autobiography. That came a bit of a shock to my closest and dearest. None of my family knew, none of my friends knew. No one around knew that I'm talking now about depression and self-harming.
Did they, I mean...
They didn't have a clue. Not one of them had a clue.
And did they feel that they wished you told them?
Yeah.
Right.
They were really struggling with the fact that they wished they could have been there for me. And I saw that sort of pain in my friends. They said, you know we're always here for you. And that made me think, you know, next time I struggle, that I need to ask my friends for support. And that's what I've done ever since, you know, because mental health doesn't just end with one occasion. But I actually think there's more power in sharing the vulnerability, because I think then, yes, we might struggle, we might need help at certain times. A lot of people that are good haven't gotten there because it's easy.
Yeah, and it's like you say, it's an important one, because the idea of someone invincible doing something amazing doesn't help someone who might be struggling, because they go, well, I'm never going to do that. But when you're honest and you pull back the curtain and you go, basically, I did this and this was the shit going on, then someone else is going to go, oh, so I could do something good with all my my own personal baggage.
I suppose that's changed with society's change, hasn't it? You know, the way we talk about lots of subjects now has changed. So I can easily sit here and have this conversation and know that it will make some difference and impact somewhere. Back then, it was almost like a taboo subject that people, and I know there's some people that then almost diminished my achievements, thinking, oh, she can't be as strong. And because I heard a radio person saying, oh, now she's not as invincible as we thought. Now she's not as this.
Really?
And what did that make me do? Think I'm going to talk about it more, because actually that's the reason why people need to hear it.
Now, we're almost out of time, but I did read a quote from you where you said that you're convinced you've yet to find your true purpose. Now, this was a couple of years ago. But
now.
So have you found it
now?
Yeah,
absolutely.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
That was it. I just wanted to make sure.
No, absolutely. You know, I say, like, I thought my athletics, I thought it was my destiny. I just think it was part of my journey. I think I've been through more challenging personal situations since retiring from athletics than I ever did with every injury, every setback, every disappointment as an athlete. And I think life brings challenges to us all. And I think we have to work out, what does that mean? You know, your biggest disappointments are your greatest life lessons. I never thought I'd change the person, because I don't feel like I'm still the same person as always been in there. But I feel that in the past 2 years, I literally owned who I am. I do not care what anyone thinks about who I say I am, what I've been through, because I know that I am responsible. I have empathy. I want to inspire. And I've seen the things that have evolved. And, you know, from anything from diversity inclusion to mental health awareness, from women's empowerment, I've been somewhere affected by something within that. And I know now that I am not scared, never fearful of showing up, being who I am and talking about what I believe in. And I think that's a power in itself. I think that's my purpose.
Dame Kelly Holmes, it's been an absolute pleasure chatting
Thank
to you.
You.
I do have three quick-fire questions.
This is the ones I can't do.
So, first of all, we've listed many of your achievements today, but which are you most proud of?
Oh, God. Winning the 1500 metres, a dream for 20 years.
Tell me the most valuable skill that you've learnt, the one that changed the way you do things.
Being my authentic self.
And finally, if you could give one piece of advice to someone wanting to follow in your footsteps.
Never give up on your own dreams.
And that is us done. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
That was great. Thank you so much. Thank you to our producer, Lauren Armstrong-Carter at Rethink Audio, to our sponsor, Lauren Perrier, and of course, the wonderful Dame Kelly Holmes. Join me again next week when we'll be opening up the Savoy's little black book to welcome another celebrated guest and ask them what it takes to be a true original. Until then, please follow us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Bye-bye.